And now coming at us directly from the United Kingdom in London, England, Mr. David Foran. David, welcome to Dark Matters.
It's a great pleasure to be with you, Don.
Okay, before the show started, I gave the audience a basic rendition of how I became interested and involved in this case. Now, this case is, of course, extraordinarily complex, especially to the layperson. What we're talking about here is, on the one hand, an assertion that, in fact, there are genuine supernatural creatures that we would call vampires, supernatural creatures that attack living human beings, drink their blood in order to maintain their existence. And on the other hand, we have somebody that says that this is complete rubbish. And you are the one maintaining that this is complete rubbish. Yet, David, you do maintain that there was a supernatural influence that you encountered at this cemetery, the Highgate Cemetery. Now, why, first, in order to be absolutely fair, why should anyone believe, on the one hand, that yes, there are supernatural influences, but yet totally discount the idea of a vampiric infestation?
Yeah, that's a very fair question. May I qualify it for you?
Certainly.
Okay. I have always maintained, and I still do now as we're speaking, I do not accept the existence of vampires. But when I use the word vampire, I'm using the word vampire in the sense of the type of vampire that's portrayed in a Hammer horror movie, or even on Buffy, if you like. That is, that sleeps in the coffin by day, wanders the streets at night, and ravages young maidens, sucks their blood, which cannot cross running water, cannot see its reflection, or you can't see its reflection in a mirror.
In other words, and all the mythology about surrounding the subject.
Yeah, well, most of it. Certainly the fact that they can be destroyed by a wooden stake being put through their hearts, yes? And that they're repelled by garlic and all that sort of, and the sign of the cross. I believe that, so I qualify that for you right at the beginning. But that, I mean, I am a psychic investigator, and I've spent my life investigating these things. On the other hand, I think I definitely believe in the existence of some supernatural entities. I don't like the word ghosts, because it always gives the wrong impression. It conjures up visions of things in white sheets and carrying their heads. No, I don't quite mean that, but I do accept the existence. Indeed, I think the evidence is overwhelming for the existence of certain apparitions which can remain earthbound and which can be actually witnessed by human beings. Now, as I said, the evidence for that seems overwhelming, and I've spent my life investigating those cases, trying to get evidence for them, spending vigils in haunted houses, deserted abbeys, or even in private houses with people's permission. And we have all the relevant, the necessary equipment to try and get the evidence we need. I'm not trying to digress, because you did ask me, really, I think you were saying, then, how is it that you can dismiss the existence of a vampire and yet still believe in these other types of entity? I guess the answer to that is that the whole myth of the vampire has been embellished. There are in existence, I don't even know, you might have even heard about them, spirits called the incubus and the succubus.
Absolutely, yes.
Oh, right, okay, that's fine. We're off to a good start. Anyway, these spirits have been recorded since the dawn of recorded history. And just for the benefit of anyone who might not know what they are, although they are listed in the dictionary, there are spirits which are supposed to visit sleeping humans at night. Now, the incubus is supposed to visit sleeping females, and the succubus is supposed to visit males.
And let's give this radio with a twist, David. Not only do they visit them in the middle of the night, but they have relations of a sexual nature with them.
Well, I deliberately held that back because I don't know how far to go on your show, but I believe that actually says that in some dictionaries. Yes, they're supposed to have sexual intercourse with human beings.
Well, that's why we call this Dark Matters Radio.
Okay, fine. Well, as long as I know. Now, the symptoms of these visitations, now I have to be really quick here because I don't want to waste time, because this on its own is a long subject. The symptoms of these manifestations are that people suddenly wake up in the night, find themselves completely and utterly or paralyzed, unable to scream, unable to even move, and they often report a tremendous pressure or as if something is kneeling on their chest.
Now, I do have some knowledge of this subject, and it sounds like what you're talking about now is the old hag.
That's very similar. Yeah, they're very similar. I think that's just another name for the syndrome.
All right.
But now, I've investigated, I've spoken to people that have had these experiences, and, well, okay, let's go back to it. Sometimes there's a sexual element involved. Now, a lot of the people I have spoken to are quite respectable people. They don't know what's been happening to them, and they often don't mention the sexual element that is involved in it. I never push it because I don't like to embarrass people. They only tell me what they want to tell me. On the other hand, though, you do meet people that have had these experiences who just come out quite openly, or obviously in private, and say, look, this happened, I was paralyzed, I couldn't move. Some people even report seeing a black shape hovering over them. And some people, not all people, but actually admit that this shape or this thing, or the incubus, or this a male, actually has sex with them against their will. Now, the other interesting thing is here that I had a young lady come to see me back in 1992. Now, she was a German lady, but she was sort of resident in England. She'd been having these attacks on a regular basis. And this only, it didn't only happen to her, it happens to a lot of other victims. The symptoms of these attacks is that people start having nightmares, usually before the attacks start. They start sleepwalking, they go off their food, they become anemic, and things like that. Now, this girl actually went to the doctor, and she was very guarded about what she could tell him. Because obviously a doctor's likely to refer to a psychiatrist. But he did confirm that she was anemic. Oh, yes, and another very important point. A lot of them become allergic to bright light or sunlight. Now, all of those symptoms are exactly the same as those attributed to cases of vampirism.
Yes.
And I'm absolutely sure when Bram Stoker wrote his fictional novel Dracula, he was aware of all these cases. Now, the incubus and the succubus, I'm convinced exist. I don't know what they are, I wouldn't claim to, but I think these entities exist. And I think that the vampire myth itself has actually arisen out of these cases, which, as I said not long back, have been recorded since the dawn of recorded history. So back to your question. Yes, I do believe in vampire-type-like entities, which these are. I mean, they're supposed to drain people of energy, paralyze them. But having said that, I do not believe in the myth that's evolved from them, which is, as I mentioned at the beginning, the myth of the blood-sucking vampire with fangs that sleeps in its coffin by day.
Okay, now that's fine. Now, first, let me tell the audience that this particular case, the Highgate vampire case, is extraordinarily complex, and there is, would it be fair, David, to state that a feud exists between your organization and Bishop Sean Manchester, who wrote the original book on the Highgate case? Would that be a fair assumption, a feud?
I could hardly deny that because it's common knowledge.
Okay. Now, I invited Bishop Manchester to also appear on this program, not with you, but by himself, in order to get his side of the story. Now, I heard from the person who identified herself as his national secretary in the UK, who basically told me that back in 1970, in October, 36 years ago and 8 months, that he stated emphatically on the record that he would never appear on any show, program, or project in which you were affiliated with, okay?
It's possible. I don't know. I've never seen the actual reference to the fact that statement exists, no, but it's possible he may have said that.
Okay, but along with that, they sent me an audio wave file with you talking about the Highgate Vampire. Now, I want to play that and get your reaction to it.
Okay. Are you going to play the whole thing while I'm on the...
No, it's only a few seconds
okay,
long.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah, that's fine.
Hang on one second here.
Okay.
Let me call this up. Now, I hope this comes through through the microphone, but if not, we can certainly insert this into the show. Hang on. Did you hear that?
I didn't, Don, but if you could tell me what it said, I can answer it.
Okay, it said...
Summarize it.
Yes, it said Well, let me play it again for my own edification.
Okay.
As to the question of whether a vampire exists in Highgate Cemetery... Well, I can only say yes, it does. And that's obviously it's you state making that statement.
That's right, and I can tell you how that statement, how that tape came about. The person, have you got the whole tape, incidentally?
No, I don't.
Oh, it's a pity. I believe the whole thing goes on for about an hour and a half. How that came about was that in 1977 or 78, I think most likely 78, I was actually seeing quite a lot of Mr. Manchester. It's a common fact. I had to go into prison in 1974. Yeah, I mean, you can ask me about that later if you want to. I don't really want to go into it, but I came out of prison in 1976 for offences relating to Highgate Cemetery. Now, Mr. Manchester was in contact with me when I was in prison. He was writing to me, and he told me when I came out of prison, I moved back to Highgate.
No, wait a minute. You were in prison in 74, and he was writing you.
That's
through,
right.
Throughout your incarceration.
That's right.
Well, then why would his organization tell me that in 1970 he stated he would have no contact with you?
Very simply, because they're lying. Look, he came to see me when I came out of prison, and like quite a few other journalists at the time, I wouldn't really call him a journalist. He told me that he wanted to write a book about the whole vampire case and my involvement in it. Now, bear in mind, that case has attracted a lot, and I mean a lot of publicity, in all the national, well, worldwide, and on the television. He asked me for permission to record me, and he brought a small portable tape recorder to my flat, and he actually recorded me. He was asking me all sorts of questions about the vampires, but he was telling me what to say. Now, that actual tape, the original, has been cut to bits. If you listen to it, you'll hear all the clicks. May I give an example? I was explaining to him the differences between Satanism and black magic. Satanism, black magic, and white magic and Wicca, which is white witchcraft. I explained to him that I'd spent the whole of my trial sort of denying that I was involved in Satanism, which I'm not, and trying to explain what Wicca really was. It is a fertility religion based on the religion and understanding and laws of nature.
Basically, early paganism.
That's right, yeah, and which I have actually been initiated into at a very early age. Now, I explained to Manchester, and I also explained on that tape, that I must tell you this, it's very important, actually, to sort of make sense of what I'm saying. I explained to Manchester that one major difference between Christianity and Wicca, I'm not talking about Satanism or black magic.
Right, yes, Wicca.
It's a religion of fertility, that they worship two deities. There's a male deity represented by the sun, and there's a female deity, no, by various names such as Selene,
Gaia?
Diana, yeah, Melusine, anyway. And she's represented by the moon. But there's also, now the male deity is represented by the sun, as I said, but he is actually, originally, Wiccans believed that Lucifer was the light bringer. He was the god of light. But when the early Christian church tried to suppress Wicca, they turned Lucifer into the Christian devil. Yes.
Yes.
And I explained all this on tape to Manchester, and it's all on the original tape. He said to me, just as one little example, he said at the end of the tape, so you worship Lucifer. So I said, in that respect, yes. But all the rest of what I said, what I've just explained to you, is completely disappeared. All the things I said to him on the tape about, I was still trying to prove my innocence of those two offences in Highgate Cemetery, all gone. All my discussions about people I knew who were involved in Wicca, all cut from the tape. All he left on the tape was certain questions that he wanted me to... he thought would sound good for his book, because what I was saying was really too tame for him. He was trying to paint me to be some sort of black magician or something, which I've always denied. So having said that in that context, if I said that, and I don't doubt that, but I'm absolutely sure he's only released a small portion of what I've said, and not, in other words, he's cut it. But it is true, he was asking me about the Highgate Vampire. It is true.
Okay.
Oh, there's another...
Now, hang on, David, because we've got to take a quick commercial break.
Sure.
And when we do that, when we come back, I want to get more into the actual Highgate case. So stand by. You are listening to Dark Matters Radio right here on the Patriot Brigade Radio Network. Back in a moment. Okay, we are back. Now, David, the Highgate case itself. This is a case that, according to Manchester's book, The Highgate Vampire, which I purchased, I bought, I read, and reread this book, the case genesis, according to his rendition, begins in 1967 with two young schoolgirls who are passing, I believe it was the North Gate, by Swan's Lane near the Highgate Cemetery. Swain's Lane.
Yeah.
And they were engulfed with visions of corpses rising from their graves. Is that pretty much it in a nutshell?
That's it. At least that's what Manchester says in his book. Yes, that's fair.
Okay, now let's get down to some specifics. The two young ladies in question, now you were a part of this from the get-go. Did you ever have any contact or meet or speak with either of these young ladies?
I spoke with one of them, yeah. One of the ladies whom Manchester names in his book, I think he's called Elizabeth Vagilia. I only hesitate on that because it's a Polish name. I'm not quite sure how you pronounce it. But he puts her name in his book and he spells it. He claims that at a later date, she actually, in the book, he claims that she was losing her appetite and that she'd been bitten by a vampire.
Yes.
This girl Elizabeth was living with somebody called Brother, who Manchester called Brother Keith. Manchester went round to the house and he gave Brother Keith some specific instruction. Anyway, he saved her by putting crucifixes around the doors and the windows, adorning her with garlic and keeping an eye on her. And he actually said to Brother Keith, he said, he claims that he was successful on that occasion, he said, but she's still very weak, so just make sure you keep feeding her on nourishing broth and she'll be okay, yeah? Now, the evidence to back that up, in the book, Manchester puts a picture of Elizabeth, is that okay?
Sure.
He puts a picture in the book of Elizabeth with two bite marks on her neck. Do you remember seeing that in the book?
No, that was, from what I understand, in the first edition that was removed in the edition I have.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Well, anyway, in the first edition, he put a picture of this, Elizabeth, a close-up with these two bite marks on her neck. I think you're right there. He didn't include that in the second edition. And the reason he probably didn't include that photo was back in 79, when I realised, after what Manchester was doing with that tape and how he was treating me, a colleague of mine actually phoned up Elizabeth at her workplace, and at the time she was living in Barnet, and she was working at a big firm called Thompson's Travel. Now, I actually recorded this, and my friend was actually Australian, which is really good because her accent helped considerably. She spoke directly to Elizabeth and she said, "I've just come back from Australia," which was actually true. She hadn't been in the country that long. And she said, I'm trying to find Mr. Manchin. I'm trying to locate him, but he doesn't seem to be at his old address." Elizabeth said, "Well, I haven't seen him for about 5 years now." Remember, this was in 1979. And she said, "So, is there any truth in the fact?" Because Manchester had been putting a story around that she had been bitten by a vampire. And Elizabeth actually said to my friend, she burst out laughing and she said, "No," she said, Sean made those marks on my neck for a joke." Now, the reason she said that, my friend said, because I've seen a picture of you, which she had. There was a book published in 1974 by Peter Underwood, the occult writer.
Yes.
And ghost author.
Which, Mr. Manchester uses his name quite prominently on his website.
Yes, I know.
In order to give more credence to this vampire mythology, I believe.
That's right, yes, he does. But the point is, Underwood used this picture of Elizabeth with the two so-called vampire marks on her neck in the first edition of his self-published book, The Highgate Vampire, which came out in 1985. But it had already been used in the 1974 Peter Underwood book. Peter Underwood included a chapter by Manchester on the Highgate Vampire, and he virtually said the same thing, that she'd been bitten by a vampire and he saved her. So, to reiterate, when my friend, actually she said to Elizabeth, she said, "Well, a picture of you in the book." And Elizabeth hadn't actually seen the book, and she described it. And then she burst out laughing, and she said, "Oh no," she said, "Sean made those marks on my neck just for a joke."
Well, now, you know, from the standpoint as a detective, a former police criminal investigator, when I read this book, David, the first thing that popped into my mind, because in the book there is a young woman that Manchester identified under the pseudonym of Lucia.
Yeah.
That he is alleging later came under attack by this vampire from Highgate.
Yeah.
Ended up dying, was buried, and then rose from the grave. Now, hey, I'm not making this up.
I know you're not.
No, I'm telling the audience this.
I'm sorry.
They're going to think that I've lost my mind. But
yeah, I know.
But she arose from the grave, and then she was preying upon the public at large, and you know, according to what he wrote in the book, thankfully near the end of the story, he tracks her down. She attacks him. He's able to fend her off. And before it's all said and done, this young woman, who's a vampire, turns into a giant spider, and he stakes the spider, and she achieves the true death and reverts back to form, and he reburies her.
That's
now,
correct, yeah.
Now, as a cop, okay, I gotta tell you, when I read that, the first thing that came into my mind was, okay, if there was any part of this that was true, okay, and I'm looking at it from a logical, investigatory standpoint, I want to find out what this woman's name was, track down her certificate of death, okay, and start the investigation from that point. Now, for years, David, I wanted to find out what her name was, and I never could track down. Now, I have a very close, very dear friend in the UK who is a renowned paranormal investigator, Mr. John Spencer, and John has been banging around all types of cases many years, he and his wife, Anne. And John, I got in touch with John, and he knew about my interest in this case. And he said, "Well, you know, I don't know if there's anything I can do, but let me see." And he, of course, could come up with nothing. So it was not until a few months ago just by the purest chance, I found a radio broadcast that you did here in the States with a couple of guys where you identified this man by name.
That's right, yeah.
Jacqueline Cooper.
That's right, yeah.
Now, when I heard that, I thought, aha, all right, now we can get somewhere. And I sent this information to my friend, and that's when I asked to get in touch with you. And I asked if he could make an introduction. Now, as an aside, and I've already kind of mentioned this at the beginning of the show, for those people that don't know it, I am a published novelist. I wrote a book called Past Sins. Yes, I'd love you to buy it, but not here to push the book. But on a chat list on Amazon USA, a horror chat, I was discussing vampires, vampire literature, and I mentioned the Highgate case. And I had told everybody I was talking to, well, you know, I'm a former police investigator, and I've always had an interest in this allegedly very real case of a supernatural vampire. And for years I've been trying to find out what this person's name was. And finally, lo and behold, it's literally as a gift dropped in my lap by David Ferrant, who has been a part of this case going back all those years, along with Sean Manchester. Now, it was not a day or maybe 2 days later, suddenly I'm hit with a flurry of very angry emails. Very angry, demanding that I remove all reference to this woman's name. Now, if it would have come from that woman, I would have understood it. But it came from an unnamed source from the Friends of Bishop Sean Manchester. Now, I got to tell you, immediately, flags raised. Flags raised. Why would, you know, this unnamed person, and if it were, in fact, Bishop Manchester, I could even understand that. But finally, after telling them, look, if you want to talk to me, give me your name, and then I'll talk to you, this person identified herself as Katrina Garforth Bless.
KGB for short, yeah.
KGB for short, right.
Yeah.
So, you know, I had a series of emails that we exchanged, and finally, and I'm trying to be humorous, I said, well, under the guise of furthering Anglo-American relations, I will remove that reference. And then they said something to me along the lines of, because I said, I would still like to talk to Bishop Manchester. And I got a note back, and they said, well, I don't know why he would want to talk to any, to some American that smeared him. Because basically in this chat, I had said, well, you know, for somebody to believe in super vampires, they're either taking opportunity to a new level, an opportunist, or they've got to be deluded. And she threw this back in my face. Now, the first thing that hit me was, why in the hell would some group in the UK be worried about a chat list here in the United States? Unless they, I don't know, have spies all over the world? KGB? I mean, you tell me, David.
Well, you've already summarized basically what Manchester said in the first edition and the second. Incidentally, have you been lucky enough, or rather, sorry, have you been unlucky enough to read Manchester's first edition?
No, I've actually, that's the original book I wanted to get my hands on.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I might be able to loan you my copy, but we'll have to arrange that in private, obviously not over the air, but I have got a copy of it myself. The whole point is, in that book, this girl, Lucia, real name Jacqueline Cooper, in the first edition of the book, there is quite a few pictures, I'm not sure how many, maybe 7 or 8 pictures, of Lucia with accompanying captions, which clearly identify her as Lucia, the girl that was attacked by the vampire and was to eventually have been staked by Manchester. For some reason, most of those pictures have all been taken out of Manchester's second edition. He's only left one in there, which is, I think is on page 72. And the caption to that is, it shows a girl, yes, that is Lucia, and she's pointing to the doors of a vault where Manchester claims in the book he followed her when she was sleepwalking.
Yes,
and
yes.
He puts that down as the vault of the Highgate Vampire, where it was sleeping, if you like.
Yes.
And he goes on in the book, this is another part of the story, how eventually he traced this king vampire to a deserted manor house in Crouch End, and there he staked it through the heart after dragging it. Oh, he found it there in a coffin. He dragged it out in the overgrown back garden. He staked it through the heart, upon which it turned to a mass of slime and sluggish versa in the bottom of the casket. He was with one other person called Arthur, he claims. Then they set light to the coffin. Oh, and I forgot to mention, when he staked it, he says in the book, a terrible roar. It emitted a terrible roar, as if from the bowels of hell. Anyway, they fetched petrol from the car. They poured it over the casket.
Now, for all our American listeners, fetching petrol from the car, gasoline.
I'm sorry, I should have said gasoline. I forgot I'm an American. Okay, end of the Highgate Vampire. But the only thing is, this vampire was, before its unfortunate demise by Manchester, was supposed to have bitten a girl, and who herself had turned into a vampire, who in turn was called Lucia. Manchester plastered her pictures through the first edition and clearly identifies her by photographs and the captions that she was the Lucia that the vampire had bitten. As I said, there's only one of those pictures remaining in the new edition on page 72, but that is Lucia herself.
Now, you knew her personally.
I knew her personally. Lucia, in fact, was the girlfriend of Manchester. She was living with him between 1969 and 1972.
Now, you spoke with her? I mean, you talked to her? You
I went
actually
to dinner at the house.
Okay.
I used to go to dinner at Manchester's house.
Now, it's my understanding, and let's get this cleared up front, that prior to the, I believe it was March 1970, was it ITV that had the big newscast at Highgate Cemetery?
That's right, yeah.
That ITV, prior to that happening, Mr. Manchester said...
Had never met me.
Had never met you.
Yeah.
But you, in fact, are saying that you did meet him before.
Yeah, I met him in... I first met him in 1967. I was actually introduced to him in 1968. I don't want to digress, Don. If I do, just pull me back, because as you said, it's a long story.
Well, no, I'm just trying to get all this clear.
He was playing the saxophone in a trio in a local pub called the Woodman in Highgate, and I and my first wife used to drink in there. That's how I was first introduced to Manchester. He knew I was well known locally for my interest in the occult, ghosts, and I actually had formed the British Psychic and Occult Society way back in 1967. But he knew all about that, and he was always asking me questions about ghosts and local hauntings and things of that nature.
Which, incidentally, for all you folks listening to this show, the UK is renowned worldwide for probably being what? One of the most haunted spots on the planet?
It's certainly got that reputation, Don, if you're addressing that to me.
Yes, well, I am.
Yeah. Yes, it certainly has. It's probably, I mean, no offence, but the UK is a very old country, whereas America is...
A very young country, yes.
Very young. I really don't wish to... I'll cause offence to anyone by saying that, but the thing, the UK's got a lot of old history, it's got a lot of old castles, a lot of old buildings... So
well, part of my family emanate from Wales and Ireland, so I mean, you know, you're not going to offend anybody.
Okay, that's fine then. I certainly don't mean to, but anyway, it's an old country, and of course, it maybe follows that it's got a lot of old ghosts too that have been seen down through the centuries. But I'm sorry, I'm digressing. What happened was, I met Manchester in '68 because he knew I had an interest in the occult and local hauntings. The Highgate Vampire hadn't really started to be seen yet until I'm sorry, I'm calling it a vampire now.
Well, the Highgate apparition.
the Highgate ghost, the Highgate apparition, wasn't really reported in earnest until 1969. But the point is, I used to go to dinner at Manchester's Holloway Road flat when he was living with Jacqueline Cooper. Now, if you want to... I suppose I can say this, it doesn't really matter because it's all on record. Manchester had already been living in the flat with his first wife and two young children. He'd moved out and Jacqueline Cooper moved in. And it was only a matter of months or a couple of years later that his first wife named Jacqueline Cooper on her divorce petition. She divorced Manchester, which she later won, and Jacqueline Cooper's name actually appears on the petition, and I believe the offence, if that's an offence, it was adultery. Those were her grounds for divorce.
Okay, now that aside, and I mean everybody loves sex, everybody loves the supernatural, at least the people listening to this show, and you don't get better than sex in the supernatural, but did this young woman die?
No, she did not.
So, you're telling me that right now, in the United Kingdom, that this woman is still alive?
Well, as far as I know, I mean, she would be well into her 50s now.
Easy, David. Today's my birthday. I'm well in my 50s.
I'm sorry, John. I don't want to talk down to you. I think I'm a bit older than you are. I mean that, anyway. No, she could still well be alive, yeah. And, of course, if she was found, that would really discredit the whole of Manchester story.
Well, you head up an organization called the BPOS. What is that?
The BPOS, those initials actually stand for the British Psychic and Occult Society.
Okay.
I founded that society in the autumn of 1967.
And it's still going on?
Oh, yes.
And you still conduct active investigations?
Oh, yes, all over the country.
And
at the time it started, it was obviously only much, much smaller. It was just local people interested in local hauntings. But over the years, it's grown, and it now has quite a huge membership, yeah.
Now, why have you not attempted to track down this lady?
We have. We certainly have. I mean, but we've just had no success.
Oh.
I can guess the only reason is, but this is my personal theory, I can't prove it. It could be that she's heard of all this nonsense that's been written about her. She could be happily married, and she could have children by now, and she just doesn't want the embarrassment of coming forward and saying, I was the Highgate vampire's disciple. I was the one that changed into a giant spider, or was supposed to have turned into a giant spider, but here I am.
Well, now the BBC, the ITV, all those... At the time that this case was at the forefront, back in the early 1970s, I would think that they would have wanted to follow up on this, if for nothing else, ratings. Did they become involved in this aspect of the case?
I think we have to... No, not to my knowledge. I think we have to remember, though, that all this was supposed to have happened. When Manchester claimed he actually staked the Highgate vampire, this was in 1973 or 1974, yes. But it was 12 years after this that he actually wrote his self-published book, The Highgate Vampire. This was really the first people heard about this giant spider story. That is when Manchester wrote this book in 1985.
Okay, so now let me do this too. Because now I have you here on the show. There are going to be a lot of people that are going to want to see what you have up on your website. Give us how to get to your website, would you?
Well, it's quite simple. Yeah, you just I'll type in my name, which is obviously davidfarrant.org.
davidfarrant.org. Now you have a FAQ up there, a frequently asked question list, don't you?
Yeah, that only went up very recently, yeah.
Okay, and you answer in this FAQ a lot of questions about this case?
Yes.
Okay, all right. Now, for anybody that wants to join in, chat with you, that type of thing, is there somewhere to do that?
Yes, we also have, we have a forum board, which can, I'm not very good on the internet at all. I only remember oldavidfan.org because it's so simple, but we have a forum board. If you go onto the main board, there's an index which will say forum. After you type in davidfan.org, main board, then you'll see on the left forum. If they click on forum, then you'll come onto the forum where people can debate or discuss whatever they want, yeah.
Okay, let's hang on for a second, David. We're going to take another break, and when we come back, more of the Highgate Vampire case. You are listening to Dark Matters Radio on the Patriot Brigade Radio Network. All right, we are back. David, now, this is one aspect of this entire case that has quite honestly fascinated me, and apparently I am not by any stretch of the imagination the only person, that since the early 1970s, and I'm going to just throw an arbitrary figure out there, about 35 to 37 years, this contention has maintained itself between you and Sean Manchester. If one goes up on the World Wide Web, you can find a number of places where this feud plays out. Up on the James Randi site, there's another website called Mondo Skepto, which I have, you know, discovered. I've been reading stuff in there. I mean, my Lord, after all these years, what is it about this case that there is still this huge bone of contention? At one point, is it not true that there were rumors that you and Sean Manchester had a duel in France?
Yes, it's true. I'm sorry. There were rumors that we had a duel,
right, yes,
in France. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that was reported in the press, yes.
Is it true that there were pictures taken of Sean Manchester with what looked like blood on him, and there were reports that he was killed?
Yes, that is true. He was supposed to be dead. And that picture was circulated by Sean Manchester together with a death note. I've got copies. If I knew you were going to ask me that, I'd try to sort it one out. But it's the funniest thing you've seen in your life. It was a notice sent down around to many occult groups and mystics in the country and other people in the press.
Well, when one is a cop, or, you know, formerly a cop, a detective, I really wanted to dig into this.
Okay, well, he put out this notice which read something like, "The world will mourn the loss of a dear and trusted friend. We are trying to raise funds to ship it." He died in France. Here's the picture of him dead after fighting a duel with David Farrant. Listen, this is on the level. I know it's funny, but it's true.
Hey, I got to tell you, we Yanks really have a genuine appreciation for that Brit humor, you know?
Well, it's true. They wanted to ship his body. I'm only summarizing this. You'd have to read the thing yourself. They want funds to ship his body back to England, where we intend to bury him at Glastonbury, a place that always close and dear to his heart, yeah? That notice, that was circulated all over the place with this picture.
Well, let me ask, was it with pistols or swords? I prefer pistols myself.
No, this one was with sabers.
Sabers?
Yeah. Now listen, Dom, this is funny. Well, it's not really so
funny. I'm sorry, that just struck my funny bone.
Yeah, okay. Well, I got a visit from the Highgate CID.
Criminal Investigation Division.
That's right. Look, this picture was being circulated to all the press by Manchester, or
surrogates?
He was supposed to be dead, wasn't he? But I mean, by his organisation asking for this fund. At the same time, the press started doing stories on it, and it somehow got into the hands of the police. So the police turned up to interview me with the picture. No, they wanted to know what I'd done with his body. This is on the level. And I actually got a bit funny with them. I said, "Look, I said it's outside UK jurisdiction. Outside UK jurisdiction." I said, "You'll have to get Interpol onto it." I actually said that, and they didn't really think it was funny. They said, "Look, we're just following up an investigation. We're not saying we believe it. But, you know, we want answers." And of course, I couldn't tell him where his body was.
Now, what in the name of God could have been the purpose of this?
Because Manchester has used my name over the years, just as you mentioned that tape to me at the beginning, yeah, of the show which you played, which I couldn't hear, but I actually fully take your word for it, what was on it. He's been using me, or rather using my name, over the years for his own publicity stunts. But it's he was the one that's always encouraged me. He said, "Look, you must say you are a black magician." He said, "People have got no interest in white magicians. You've got to say you're a black magician. You've got to admit, you've got to say you sacrifice cats." All this is nonsense, and
something tells me I'm going to be in the spotlight here in this with this bunch when this is all said and done.
I'm used to it. The best of luck.
Okay, now there's another question that I've come across in many of these websites, literally, I guess, around the world, that deal with the Highgate vampire case, David Ferrant and Sean Manchester, and that is whether Sean Manchester is, in fact, an ordained member of the clergy of the Old Catholic Church, the Old Catholic faith, not Roman Catholic.
No.
There is a genuine difference. So there is an organized religious organization, Old Catholic Church. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct, yeah.
All right, now, he goes by Bishop Sean Manchester. Now, I understand that controversy has erupted on whether he is, in fact, a legitimate, genuine man of the cloth. Now, first, let me ask you this. Does he have an actual parish where he gives the sacraments?
In a word, no. And his correct title is Mr. On his website, please don't ask me to pinpoint the actual one, it's been up all over the place. On his website, he claims he's an old Catholic bishop. He claims that he's recognized by the Vatican. He claims he's recognized by the American Old Catholic Church, which is genuine, and that exists too. And he claims that he's recognized by the English Old Catholic Church. I'm sorry, not the English Catholic. The old English Catholic Church and the one in Holland, which is run by Archbishop Glazemaker. Now, we have contacted the American Old Catholic Church, and guess what? Never heard of him. We've contacted, I haven't personally, but my secretary did some while ago. She contacted the Vatican. They never heard of him. She also contacted one of the papal secretaries, and the Vatican had never heard of him. We contacted the Old Catholic Church in Holland, as I said, is run by Archbishop Glazemaker. They categorized that Manchester was ever ordained as one of their bishops. And the English Old Catholic Church, we contacted them as well, and they exactly the same thing. He's nothing whatsoever to do with us.
So in other words, that Mr. Manchester, in fact, does not have a recognized parish. Is that correct?
Yes, it's absolutely correct. I mean, the only our parish, he sometimes calls himself the Bishop of Glastonbury, which of course doesn't have a parish at all.
Okay, now, here in the States, David, one can send their check or money order into the Universal Life Church and get back a certificate where one is an ordained minister of the Universal Life Church. You can legally perform marriages and anything that the clergy can do.
Yeah.
Now, is that available in the UK? Something like that?
I've certainly heard of it in America. I think the same thing, not on such a big scale. I think it's available in the UK, yeah. And I think that's exactly what Manchester did. When he got himself ordained, in quotes, he hired out a church in Barnet, the United Reformed Church. He invited loads and loads of his friends round. He had the whole thing videoed, and loads of still photographs were taken. And he was also issued with a mass-produced certificate. Now, he was selling this certificate on the internet. I saw this myself for about £5 for a copy of the certificate, which he claimed entitled to call himself a bishop. He was selling the videotape of his order, of his consecration, whatever you call it, on the internet, because I saw this too, for £14.99.
Now, how much is that in US dollars?
My rough guess is that there's $2 to the pound.
Okay. All right.
Roughly.
So $28-$30.
Yeah, and I'm not sure. I cannot remember whether that was supposed to include the postage or not.
Postage and handling.
Yeah, but he was selling this nonsense on the internet of his staged ordination, or consecration rather, because he claims he was made into a bishop. So, hey Don, I'm sorry, I really have forgotten your question. Now, were you asking me about if he's a genuine bishop?
Yes, yes.
No. That is a simple answer to that.
Okay, now I'm sure that they would dispute that mightily, but David, I guess what you're telling me is, as far as any case of an actual supernatural vampire, we can lay that to rest. Now, let's get back to what I originally asked you way back at the beginning when we brought you on. You are maintaining that there was, in fact, some type of diabolical entity, spirit, something?
I'd use the word malignant myself, yeah.
But there actually was something.
Yes, there definitely was. I actually saw something myself.
Now, in Manchester's book, one of the things that piqued my interest was the report that there were dead, bloodless animals that had been found in Highgate Cemetery. Now, at the beginning of the show, before I brought you on, I talked about a case that I was involved in as a criminal investigator with some mutilated cattle many years ago,
yeah,
where the animals were dead, mutilated, and bloodless. Now, that, in fact, piqued my curiosity about the whole Highgate vampire connection.
Yeah.
Is that true?
I've heard of cattle mutilation, yes.
No, I mean, were there dead animals?
I'm sorry. Well, according to Mancha, I actually found a dead fox myself, and there are foxes breeding in Highgate Cemetery because it's so overgrown. Well, certainly used to be, anyway. I actually found a dead male fox in the middle of a pathway when I was visiting the cemetery in the daytime. Now, it used to be open to the public in those days. I was very curious about this because it did seem, although it had moisture around its neck seemed to be all wet, but I couldn't really tell if it was mud or whatever, but it was stiff and it was dead right in the middle of a main pathway. And what struck me was, I thought, well, look, foxes are extremely cunning animals. Well, most wild animals are, and if they sense death, they usually crawl away into the undergrowth to die. Something had killed that fox, and it had done it very, very suddenly. Now, I actually saw that myself, so I can verify that, yes. There were foxes breeding in the cemetery, yes. Manchester claims in his book that there were many, many more animals found dead. I can't verify that. I've got a feeling I actually said at the time that to a local newspaper that I'd found this fox, and I found it rather unusual because of the circumstances of its death, and I think it's possible Manchester picked up on that and sort of exaggerated it.
Okay, now there was one other question I had that really interested me about this case. And when I first read it, I could not make a determination. It was not made clear whether this was a fresh victim or one of the corpses from the cemetery. But there was a report that during the height of the vampire hysteria, that a body of a woman was found in front of one of the tombs, missing her head.
That's right, that's correct.
What's the real story about that?
Well, the real story is it wasn't just... I didn't actually see that myself, but it was reported in the press and confirmed during my court case, actually, because the police brought all this out in court. They were trying to make me a scapegoat for all the vandalism in Highgate Cemetery. And so all these cases, they called the cemetery superintendent, a man called William Law, and he stated in court, which was reported by the press, a lot of other cases that I didn't know about. People had been going into the cemetery and ripping open coffins, many of which were kept in large Victorian vaults, so they were fairly accessible, and putting stakes through corpses. And the reason they were doing this is, in my opinion, is that because of Manchester's statements on the television, when he actually... He appeared in that first ITV program with myself, and he produced a homemade wooden stake and a very large crucifix, and the interviewer, Sandra Harris, almost jumped back and knocked the cameraman over. But she said, "What's that for?" And Manchester said there'd already been local reports that it could have been a vampire egged on by Manchester because of the fact it was often reported as having hypnotic red eyes, and it was quite a tall figure. Manchester said that I'd actually interviewed quite a few local witnesses who had witnessed it, and I actually saw it myself on one occasion, but then again I was only witnessing what other people had already seen. With this in mind, with that background in mind, Manchester went onto the television and said that in his opinion the frequently witnessed spectre, apparition, whatever you want to call it, was really the king vampire of the undead. And he went on to say, and the only Sandra Harris said, "Well, what are you going to do with those?" He said, "Well, the only way to destroy a vampire, the only sure way, is to drive a wooden stake through its heart, cut off its head with a gravedigger's shovel with one blow, then burn what remains."
Now that's right out of Stoker's novel.
Well, I know. Well, the point is, he said that on television, so no wonder that statement alone. And he 6 months later, he went on television again on the BBC, again with myself, although we were interviewed separately. And he repeated exactly the same thing. On that program, the BBC, he pulled a sharpened wooden stake out of the back of his trousers. He had it stuck down his trousers, concealed. He pulled out the cross, and he just repeated what he said on the ITV program. That was how you destroy a vampire, and that the Highgate Spectre was really the king vampire of the undead. And it's little wonder that a lot of gullible people, hooligans and what have you, or just plain cranks, seeing that sort of... only takes a few gullible people to seeing that sort of statement, or statements made on the television, would given them the idea to do just that. So I would say, actually, Mr. Manchester was directly responsible for most of that vandalism.
Now, over here in the States, one could suggest that he might be culpable to be for inciting a riot hysteria or something. I mean, what I'm saying is that over here, there's a possibility that one could be arrested for doing that type of thing, creating.
Yeah. Well, as it turned out, I was the one that ended up getting arrested, because I said the police wanted, in 1974, they were looking for a scapegoat for all the vandalism that had been going on in Highgate Cemetery. And I, got blamed for a lot of things I didn't do. For the record, I faced five major charges of desecration in Highgate Cemetery. I was acquitted on the major three. I got found guilty of two lesser ones, which involved vandalism and or painting black magical marks on the floor of a small chapel. I hadn't done.
Okay, no, now yeah. in the guise of full disclosure, I have seen a photograph of you in a cemetery holding a crucifix and a stake.
Yeah, that's correct.
What is the story behind that?
Manchester's always making an extremely big thing of that, saying he still desperately still wants to put me over as a vampire hunter, which I'm just not. I'm a psychic investigator. The story behind that is that I was taken to court in 1970 and charged with vampire hunting. I was caught with others inside Highgate Cemetery. Now, I was taken to court, but on that occasion I was acquitted, as the cemetery was not a legally enclosed area, and the judge said at the end of the trial he was quite satisfied that I was not in the cemetery to cause any damage. But the whole point is that, having been on the television, people started to cash in on my involvement with the so-called Highgate Vampire. So I was invited onto the BBC following my acquittal, who were doing a story on the Highgate Vampire, and they brought along a cross and a stake. And I think...
Who did this?
The BBC.
The BBC?
Yeah, and they wanted me to use these as props, because I've been branded as...
Was this a news show?
Yeah.
And they brought you props?
Yeah, they brought me... Well, it was a news show. The name of the program was 24 Hours.
Boy, I'll tell you what, that now that would not be done here, at least not admitted to. I find that astounding.
Well, whether they'd admit to it or not, I don't know, but they certainly bought the props for me and said that as I'd been acquitted, they could run the program, but they wanted to put me over as a vampire hunter. I mean, they didn't ask me to stake anything or anything like that, but they certainly filmed me in Highgate Cemetery.
Well, I would have told that news interviewer to put that stake where the sun doesn't shine, David. They were setting you up, my friend.
Yeah, well, I was pretty young in those days. I was about 24, and you do a lot of stupid things when you're younger. In retrospect, you wish you hadn't done, but I'm afraid that's just life.
Well, yeah. Sometimes it can come back and bite you on the derriere.
That's right, and sometimes you only just get the wrong person. They don't let that sort of thing go. But no, I'm not a vampire hunter. The BBC wanted to reconstruct, I think that's how they put it, me vampire hunting, and hence the cross and the stake in Highgate Cemetery.
Oh, boy. Well, David, what is the bottom line now?
You mean regarding the Highgate Vampire?
Yes, the bottom line regarding the Highgate Vampire and regarding what you're involved in now, and just where do you see any of this going? Do you think it will continue, this feud? Do you think that this is one of those things that will go on in perpetuity?
I'm afraid, yeah, because... I know everybody says this if there's an argument between two people, but this feud is really one-sided. Anyone looking on the internet, taking the trouble to dredge through it, you know, if they can really be bothered, will find that most of my remarks have been to retract what Manchester's been saying about myself. 99% of the posts by me have been put up to retract what Manchester's been saying about myself and my involvement. So, as far as he's concerned, I think he'll continue this feud till he dies. It's unwanted as far as I'm concerned, because I investigate far too many other cases. I write about my investigations, I write books, I write articles, and they're not all about the Highgate Vampire. But since you mention it, just as a point of interest, yes, I did see that apparition myself way back in 69. I don't know what it was, it just disappeared. It was standing inside the top gate. A lot of other people, I just confirm that a lot of other local people had seen it. It suddenly disappeared, but it was based on something. I honestly believe there's some earthbound spectre there. And the point I was leading up to is that psychic energy doesn't just go away. It can lie dormant for many years, and all of a sudden it can become active again. Often it can lie dormant in stone. If that stone is disturbed, it can somehow release the psychic energy, which is exactly what happened at Highgate Cemetery. They were doing some building work, hadn't been seen for a few years, and only in 2005, that is in March and July, I think those are the right months, those are the months, yeah. This figure was witnessed again twice by two independent witnesses at Highgate Cemetery. So I think the thing, whatever it is still active for Highgate Cemetery.
Well, let me just say this before we end this interview, that I have extended an invitation to Bishop Sean Manchester to come on this program and to discuss the case in any way that he wishes to talk about it. I heard from one of his associates who said he would not be interested in doing that. I wrote them back and once again extended the invitation, and I'm extending it now. I am positive that they will listen to this show.
So am I, yes.
I'm positive that they will listen to this show. Now, what? One other thing before we do sign off. And when I first encountered Manchester's site, and it's primarily about Highgate, there's a lot of information in there on the Highgate vampire case, and other cases, including one in, I hope I say this right, Kirklees.
That's right, yes.
Which is allegedly the burial site of Robin Hood,
yeah,
of British legend and history.
Yeah.
Another alleged vampire site there. But one thing I saw in his website, and he has a lot of information up there, he is directly descended from Lord Byron, the famous poet. Is that correct?
Yeah, and also don't forget, he's directly descended from King Arthur. He said that before, if indeed King Arthur ever existed. He claims he was directly descended by raw blood to King James I of England, and his wife is directly descended by blood from Charles II. Manchester also claims that, as you just said, he is a direct descendant of the poet Lord Byron. Yes, that's absolutely correct. I mean, that's what he claims is correct, yeah?
Okay, now, I have a very good friend who is a very well-known American actor and on stage, screen, television, Mr. Dwight Schultz. And when I was talking to, and you may know him from Star Trek or the A-Team, he played the crazy helicopter pilot, Howling Mad Murdoch.
Yes.
Wonderful, wonderful actor, and we're very good friends. Dwight did a play regarding Lord Byron a number of years ago, and Lord Byron was quite the scamp, from what I understand.
Yeah.
Quite the scamp. I don't want to go into all the gory details that Dwight made me privy to regarding Lord Byron's private life, but they were juicy.
Yeah.
Now, it's my understanding he is claiming direct descent because Lord Byron had a tryst with one of the housemaids?
That's right, yeah. There was a woman, housemaid, called Lucy. I actually put in one of my books that I was describing this, and I said that all it really proves, if it is correct, that Manchester's descended from some domestic prostitute. No, I've published that, but I actually make it quite plain that I don't believe a word of it.
Well, it's interesting, David. It's very... David Ferrant, I want to thank you for taking time out of your schedule to join us here on Dark Matters. This has been an absolutely fascinating, and I have looked forward to this with great anticipation. I am not in any way sorry we had you on. This has been genuinely delightful. I want to thank you. And do you have any words that you want to leave with the audience?
I'm not very good at quotes and sayings, Don. But
well, then I'll make it easy for you. Give us your website again.
Oh, it's davidfarrant.org.
And that's pretty simple. David, of course, David, Ferrant, FARRANT.org.
Yeah, simple as that. My name and org on the end. Not OG, org, O-R-G.
O-R-G. Well, David, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure, Don, and I really look forward to seeing if Manchester will take up your invitation.
Well, I've extended it. I'm sure I will hear something. And in the meantime, ladies and gentlemen, this has been a program on the Patriot Brigade Radio Network. My name, your host, is Don Ecker. And when we are back, we're going to have another exciting show. I've got some really great programming coming up. I had a telephone call the other day from a very old, very dear friend, Mr. Zachariah Sitchin, whom many of you will know is the author of the world-renowned series The Earth Chronicles. Mr. Sitchin has a new book out that I, as a matter of fact, got a copy of. I've read it. We're going to be interviewing him next week. Also, up and coming, a program on new exclusive information on the JFK, John Fitzgerald Kennedy assassination. I had a call from a television producer that I know that are currently working on a series of specials dealing with JFK's murder and the American Mafia. And we have lots of other stuff coming up, like Bloodline, the movie. Haven't heard about it yet? Well, you're going to be talking to hearing the two executive producers of Bloodline, the movie. What's it about? Well, the real story behind Jesus and Mary Magdalene, and the possibility that Mary Magdalene, yeah, the same one from the Bible, is actually buried in France. Vicky and I saw a screening of the film. It is a mind blower. Hey, that's it for now. Keep those eyes pointed up. Until next time.